The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Breaking news, the U.S. unemployment rate in April shows that it was a major miss on estimates. Just 266,000 jobs were added, much lower than the 1 million jobs that were expected. The biggest miss on record.
Copper is becoming the next oil in some sense. It's our green version of oil. And the price has just really skyrocketed. And so we are really seeing these phenomenal opportunities in commodities where most investors don't realize that bonds and stocks have done a lot in the last 10 years. But frankly, commodities have been one of the few assets that have been in a downward trend in most cases. And so now we're really seeing that commodities are the leader of where we could be going forward in terms of inflation.
According to crypto firm NYDIG, hundreds of U.S. banks are asking for Bitcoin, planning to allow customers to buy, hold, and sell the digital currency through their existing accounts as soon as this year.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Stocks continue to move higher to new record levels as bullishness over corporate earnings and stimulus weigh on the market. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me at the top of the hour will be Financial Sense's Frank Barbera as we look at the different markets, and especially as we look at gold, silver, and copper. Later on in the program, Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. But before that, let's see what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Inflation was the name of the game this week, and it all started with Warren Buffett's comments at the Berkshire Hathaway annual shareholder meeting last weekend. We're seeing substantial inflation. We're raising prices. People are raising prices to us. And it's being accepted, said Buffett. He continued by saying, we really do a lot of housing. The costs are just up, up, up. Steel costs, just every day, they're going up. He called it a red-hot economy and that he wasn't expecting it. What's interesting is that we're seeing strong economic reports this week overall, yet the biggest inflation indicator of them all, the long-dated Treasury yield, seemed to dismiss Buffett's concerns. The 10-year Treasury yield finished down 5.4 basis points this week to finish at 1.57%, with a sizable drop in the yield on Friday after the jobs data disappointment, causing Treasury bonds to rise before selling off after the initial reaction. Monday, Fed Chair Powell fired back on inflation that it remains under control, still holding to his call last week and actually a month ago that they're not even thinking about raising interest rates. Tuesday, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, in an interview with The Atlantic, said rates may need to rise to prevent the economy from overheating, mainly as a result of increased government spending. But the following day on Wednesday, with Chicago Fed President Evans and Fed Vice Chair Clarita, Yellen clarified her comments that they were not a prediction nor a recommendation the Fed needs to raise rates in response to fiscal spending. So, clarification there. Underneath the surface this week, there have been ongoing gentle rotations out of tech and out of growth areas of stocks and into cyclicals based on continued reopening efforts and positive economic data. After testing all-time highs in the Nasdaq last week, the index suffered four consecutive losses before a buy-the-dip reaction on Thursday. At one point, the Nasdaq was down 3.8% this week before recovering to a decline of only 1.5% on the week. By week's end, the best four performing sectors were energy at the top, followed by materials, financials, and industrials. It was a very busy week in earnings, but like weeks past, it hardly was noticed at the index level. Shifting gears here, let's take a look at the economic highlights of the week. The ISM Manufacturing Index cooled down to 60.7 from 64.7 in March. The prices component, however, jumped 89.6%, sitting at its highest level since 2008. The ISM non-manufacturing index also cooled down a little bit to 62.7 in April from 63.7 in March, but activity is still near record levels. Factory orders for manufactured goods increased 1.1% in March after a decrease of 0.5% in February, which indicated the drop was merely weather-related. On the jobs front, let's take a look. The ADP private payrolls announced on Wednesday was up 742,000 jobs, which were created in April. Unemployment claims fell 92,000 to 498,000, the lowest level since March 14th of 2020. So we continue to see that trend continue down. On the flip side of things, the jobs data on Friday showed a weak addition of only 266,000 jobs added, which was about one-third of expectations. And the unemployment rate actually rose to 6.1% from 6%, just as we are reopening. Moody's said that the report was mixed at best, with shipping and production challenges weighing on transportation and warehousing and manufacturing. But consumer-facing industries have continued to recover as states loosened pandemic restrictions. Moody's believes the factors contributing to the disappointing report should be temporary. However, shipping snags and chip shortages, especially in automotives, could continue to stick. Moody's also said that commodity prices could be hurting activity, citing surging lumber prices constraining activity despite high demand for housing. There was a lot of criticism on Friday about the jobs report, that it was underwhelming in part and due to generous unemployment compensation. Moody's said the impact is likely marginal in that regard, though also stated many service industry jobs are paying less than unemployment benefits. So some truth is probably there. The Biden administration and Janet Yellen also defended the position and disagreed with that notion that unemployment benefits are keeping unemployment high. The stock market indices rallied strongly after the initial hit took the indices into negative territory, mainly as the view of a weak employment environment would continue to hold the Fed's foot firmly to the floor on accommodation. And that sums up the week. Jim, back to you.
Every 4 years, the Bitcoin protocol is pre-programmed to reduce the number of Bitcoins that are generated every 10 minutes. And so the way it was initially designed, when miners verify transactions for other parties, when a new block is added to the blockchain, which is every 10 minutes on average, they earn 50 Bitcoins for being the winner to put the next block on the blockchain. And after 210,000 blocks, which is almost exactly 4 years, that is pre-programmed to go down to 25 new Bitcoins per block. And then, you know, 4 years later, it was 12.5 Bitcoins. And then, you know, the 4 years later, 6.25 Bitcoins. And so what that does is kind of like any commodity market. If you have a relatively persistent demand for Bitcoin and the new supply flow gets cut in half, that generally puts upward pressure on the price.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the stock market seems to keep powering higher with low interest rates and more stimulus on the way. It could be the largest stimulus program in U.S. history. Not since 1944 or 45 has the government spent this much money. Well, what does this mean for the market? Let's find out. Joining us is Financial Sense's Frank Barbera. Hey, Frank, before we get to the market, can you tell me, what is this Bitcoin thing? I keep hearing about Bitcoin. Is that like coins for laundromat? What is this?
You know, Jim, I'm not sure. I actually think you use it for a parking meter. That's what I think it gets used for. You just drop one of those Bitcoins in the parking meter and you're all good. But I've never tried it at a laundromat. Have you done that?
No, I haven't done it, but I keep hearing people talk about Bitcoin and stuff like that. And I don't know. I thought maybe you would know. Okay.
I'm not going to use for it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the market. Two things on the market, Frank. We've got the Dow Jones Industrial Average, higher levels, transports, higher levels. So Dow theory supporting another market move. You got the S&P at higher levels, but the NASDAQ has been struggling. What is that telling you?
Well, you know, I agree. The NASDAQ big tech has definitely struggled quite a bit over the last few days. It looks like, you know, it ran into a lot of resistance on the NASDAQ composite around 14,150. We had a high back on February 10th and then another high on April 29th. So you've got these two important peaks in the NASDAQ right at the same level. There was a low right around March 5th at 12,600. Right now it's conceived entirely possible that the NASDAQ is just taking a breather. It's had a very long run. A lot of the very high momentum, high glamour names, high PE glamour names on the NASDAQ have sold off, even in the face of pretty good earnings. I noticed the chip sector in particular. The SOX index is down around 8% over the last 15 to 20 days. So we've seen some profit taking, and maybe, you know, that could conceivably be part of a healthy rotation within the stock market, with other sectors like energy and base metals moving up to the fore and assuming the mantle of leadership. So it's very distinctly possible that this market continues to rise with a rotational aspect to it.
Let's talk about another thing that we're starting to rise, and that's inflation. In fact, at this weekend's Berkshire Hathaway meeting, Warren Buffett bringing his shareholders up to date on the inflation aspects, because obviously a lot of the companies that they're dealing with, they're seeing a lot of material and price increases. So let's talk about inflation, you know, whether you're looking at lumber, whether you're looking at copper prices, gasoline prices, fuel prices, everything is rising. And a follow-up question that I think we need to talk about is Janet Yellen coming out recently saying that they may have to start taper or raise interest rates. So let's talk about those two.
Well, I think there's no question about it, Jim. On the inflation front, I actually listened to the whole meeting, what I could see in terms of the transcript, read through it, and Buffett was very clear about prices. He was talking about how big a presence they had in the home building market and how all different kinds of prices have been moving up. During this earnings season, if you go through a transcript of the earnings conference calls from all of the companies, and now we're substantially through with a lot of that, the terms higher price pressure, higher prices, all of these inflation-related terms have surged in terms of their usage. And it's really funny. If you actually look at the conference call language and you search for references to rising inflation, what we've seen now is an exponential blowout to the upside in corporate America. And strangely enough, that actually is a very good leading indicator for actual inflation coming up. So I have no doubt. In fact, I would say that the inflation storm that's directly ahead in the next 2 to 5 months, potentially, is not a Category 1 hurricane or a Category 2 hurricane, but it's more in the latter of a Category 4 or a Category 5. Lumber prices have basically, they're going lock limit up. You're seeing things in the lumber market that have never been seen before. Copper prices are moving sharply higher. The one thing that, if you look at the commodity ETF, it's called DBA. That ETF is a basket of commodities. And from the absolute lows to where we are now, about a year ago, we made lows in March. There's a beautiful, it's almost an irrefutable Elliott wave pattern. We had a wave one on August 30th of last year, a wave two low on October 29th, a third wave up on February 24th, and a fourth wave low on March 30th of this year. And we are in a fifth wave. Now, the thing about commodity patterns, when you're in a fifth wave, they can extend. They can be, the fifth wave in commodities can be absolutely explosive. And over the last 2 days, the DBA ETF has moved up and outside the upper trend line of a parallel price pattern that's very clear and easy to see on the chart. So we're in a situation where, at least in the near term, as Bank of America sort of said the other day, you're sort of in a short term. I wouldn't use the word hyperinflation. That's what they said. But I think you're definitely getting where materials prices are concerned, very aggressive inflation coming through. And that's going to put pressure on corporate earnings, I think, going forward in terms of shrinkage in gross margins. So there's some definite risks. And the big one is what's really unusual, and I know has a number of veteran market watchers, Doug Kass, a number of hedge fund managers that I've read, kind of nervous, is this whole idea of tapering, because I don't think we've ever seen a situation where prices are moving up this aggressively, this quickly, and the Fed has been this uber dovish. The dot plot could not be any easier. The language could not be any easier. And so you wonder, at what point do they try to just cheek it through and hope that it's a, you know, category one hurricane that just sort of fizzles out as it hits land? Or is this going to intensify with the winds and turn into the category four or five that it certainly looks like right now? And then they're going to have to say something. And then what happens when they actually taper? And that's one of the thoughts that floats around a lot in the back of my mind and you know, has me with a little bit of a guard up. But I definitely see the price push to the upside is remarkable. Nothing less than remarkable.
Frank, the other issue that we're dealing with, so far we're talking about material costs going up. But the other thing that employers are starting to see now, with the unemployment benefits higher than what most people can make on minimum wage, a lot of the employers are saying that they're being forced to raise wages in order to acquire workers. What is that? In a sense, you've got another factor that comes in here, which is wage inflation. And we all know how the Fed reacts when they start seeing the labor markets react.
Jim, I don't see how that the problem is with a lot of this stuff is it tends to become ingrained. You get companies like Smucker's Jam or McCormick raising prices on spices, and or Coca-Cola raising prices, which they said they were going to do, Procter & Gamble. Then it's very, very difficult to repeal these price increases. So there tends to be a stickiness to price increases. And the same is true with wages. I think in the case, it's absolutely true, though, in the case of rising wages, especially a mandated minimum wage, that actually creates more unemployment over time, because you're forcing companies to do more, the same amount of work with less people. A lot of times they can't afford to hire as many people, so they actually trim hiring. So there can be a self-limiting aspect to a lot of this, and only time will really tell. But the Fed is definitely in a very unusual position right now for where we are in this particular point in the cycle.
So let's talk about somebody that's doing well with inflation. Frank, I want to talk about the precious metals. On the day you and I are doing this interview on a Thursday, we've got silver breaking out, gold took off today. But more importantly, I want to address the issue that we've seen with the miners. The miners have been sort of lagging a little bit, but now you take a look at some of these earnings. I don't care if you're looking at BHP, if you're looking at Freeport, if you're looking at Newmont, Barrick, reported blowout earnings on Wednesday and saying that they may be paying special dividends. So let's talk about the miners and precious metals. How do they look here on the charts?
Well, let me say first, on a fundamental basis, I couldn't agree with you more. I love what's happening at the miners. Barrick and Newmont have reorganized their businesses over time so that they're basically all in sustaining costs on gold are around $1,200 an ounce. They're refocused. This is a much better situation in these stocks than we've seen in years. as the management is focused on boosting dividends, and all of the big mining companies have done that. I definitely think that in the larger picture, we are seeing peak gold, where we're going forward. It's going to be harder and harder to find new deposits on gold to get them permitted. There's a lot of geopolitical tension around the world. There are even countries in Latin America that are actively talking about conscripting resources, you know, taking them away, confiscating them. So all of these things are very, very positive for gold. Right now, you know, I kind of think it's sort of right on the edge. The gold price has had a nice move up. We're currently trading right around 1813. Today, we broke through the 100-day moving average. Gold is still below its 200-day average, which is 1854. And I would pick short-term support right now at around 1790. There's a trend line up on the near-term chart across the April 13th, April 30th, and May 21st lows that comes in right around 1790 right now, be up to about 1795 next week. Yet with all of that, it's just still not clear to me. My long-term model on gold has been negative for 6 months. It's still negative through today. I ran it about an hour ago. The medium-term model just flipped positive, and my short-term model is positive. So I do see improvement taking place in the gold market. There's a Fibonacci resistance. If you go from the absolute high on August 7th of 2020 on gold at 2075 to the recent March 8th low this year at 1676, a 0.382 Fibonacci resistance level is at 1826, and we're at 1813 right now. I think if gold can move through 1830, that's probably very bullish, and I wouldn't fight that. I would go with that. But I think it does have some resistance in this area, and it is also getting overbought short term. So the jury is, I think it's improving, and it seems to be trying to turn the call. And there's actually no other sector out there that's more important to me to be watching than gold and silver. I've spent a good chunk of my life watching these markets, and if they decide to make a big turn to the upside, I definitely want to be aggressively invested in them. So they're very important markets, I think, for all investors. When you look at the economy today and the fact that it's heating, it's running very hot. Also the fact that the government is spending a lot of money and we're going to be running huge, unprecedented deficits. The precious metals markets, gold and silver, are the first line of defense against currency devaluation. And so for all investors, they should be, you know, focused on them with laser-like precision. And that's certainly where I'm at. But they would also be markets that could be vulnerable if the Fed decided to taper. And so that's one of the missing ingredients in this. That's a part of the mystery right here in the short term that we just don't know the answer to. And that's why we have to be very, very attentive to what price is actually trying to tell us. So I'm optimistic. I'm also watching the dollar index part and parcel with gold. The dollar index is around 90.99 as we speak right now. And there is very important support on the dollar index around 89.20. So it has a little bit of freedom to move around in here. But I think if the dollar index breaks down through the support, which it has not yet broken down, that would be another indication that it's a big green light for gold and a big green light for silver. So I think right now we're in sort of the active daily monitoring mode where we watch closely and see how this plays out here in the very short term. I will point out one last thing on gold, Jim. There's a turning point pattern that comes in on May 10th. That's about 2 days from now. Which it's a Fibonacci time pattern from the highs of August 6th of last year to the November 30th low of 2020 was about 80 days. And if you do a 1.382 multiple off that low, you come up with May 10th, which is about 2 days from now. if the gold market can really persist and remain strong past May 10th, I think that's a pretty good sign. There are a couple of turning point patterns right in the next 2 to 3 days that I'm watching. And either we're going to get a failing high in here, or it's going to continue to persist over the next couple of days. If it does that, it's probably breaking into the clear. And then we've got to get the dump truck out and start, you know, start loading up the boat.
So, Frank, when getting back to interest rates and possible future moves by the Fed, what do you think it's going to take before the Fed would move? I mean, this is the first time, you know, if you go back to the beginning of the year when everybody was talking about the Fed's not going to do anything to 2023, 2024 at the earliest, all of a sudden that dynamic has changed here with the rise of inflation, where you now got Yellen saying, maybe we need to start raising interest rates or that could happen. So it, you know, she's sort of hinting at it may not be 2022 or 2023 before they move.
That would come as a huge shock to risk assets if they do that. And that's the wild card. That's in every market. I think there's always an unknown, some variable out there that's in left field. And right now, that's certainly one of the top list items on the list. So it's really hard to say. I mean, it's surprising that the Fed really let this go this far, because, you know, most observers, most veteran observers are noticing this. It's not a benign rise in inflation. It's an outright explosion in inflation. You've got supply chain issues combining in with the reopening of the economy. And the Fed is sitting there very, you know, calmly saying, oh, this is just transitory. Well, it better be transitory, because if they have to start shifting policy, you know, I have no idea what's going to happen. But it's a very unusual situation.
You know, it's kind of strange, Frank, because we're trying to work our way out of the pandemic. The economies are opening up. Several states now have even gotten rid of masks. So we're, you know, there's a lot of cash that consumers are sitting on. I mean, if you've been locked up in your house for 12 months, you know, they're anxious to go out, take vacations, travel, spend some money. And when you see that, you kind of wonder if we are possibly making the same mistakes that we made in the 30s, where, you know, Roosevelt came in, he devalued the dollar, got rid of deflation. The Fed kept interest rates low, and we had this booming economy and market. People forget there was about a 4-year period in the 30s where the market did well. But in 1937.
32 to 37, that's exactly right.
Yeah, they came in 1937. The Fed started raising interest rates. The government cut back on spending. Well, I don't think we have to worry about the government cutting back on spending. But if the Fed starts raising interest rates and on top of that, they throw in higher taxes, I can't help but think that that would have an impact on the economy.
Back then, the market dropped 50% and in short order. And, you know, this situation today is there's a dynamic out there. And I think there's I would argue that embedded in this situation is a risk factor. You've got a couple of groups of people out there. You've got people who are looking at this trend and extrapolating the growth forward and saying, okay, things are going to be great. We want to be fully invested. Then you've got other people in there who are looking at the trend and saying, we're going to try and ride the wave. But everybody is fully focused on the Fed and Fed policy. And we've had this sort of policy of transparency over the last few years, where in the old days, you didn't know, you didn't have any idea. Fed policy was always opaque. They would just have a meeting and sometimes they would just surprise people with a hike in the prime rate or a cut in the Fed funds rate out of nowhere. And the markets would react. But in the last few years, we've had this huge trend towards increased transparency, wordsmith activity. Every conference call the Fed does, there's changing in the adjectives, and all the market participants are zeroed in on what I would call these infinitesimally small changes in wording, changes in these dots. And so you've got to keep people really looking for just the slightest vibration in the tectonic plates of monetary policy. And they're sort of pre-programmed right now at making an effort at escape if that vibration in monetary policy should even start to wiggle just a bit. And that is something I think that is unique to this current time period, that monetary policy has never been so much front and center and never has been hanging so much in the balance of a word or two. Forget about an action. This will move on, you know, basically the open market committee, one or two governors coming out and just saying something that sounds in the slightest perception different. And that, I think, makes it very challenging. So that's one reason when I manage money, I try to put money out there, but I always have a risk control discipline over it. You have to have a stop loss. And the good thing about everything we do, all of us at Financial Sense, is we have a break. And that's what makes our firm, I think, totally unique and different from other firms out there. And because that ultimately that risk control discipline, which exists in the money management process, is a great formula for creating peace of mind and a good sleep well at night feeling for clients. And that's why I'm very happy to be part of this.
So, Frank, as we close, if you were to hedge against inflation, what, in your opinion, is the best way to do that?
Well, there's no question. JP, I've studied it. If you go back in history, the number one attack dog for inflation, if inflation is rising and it's moving aggressively sequentially up, silver is always the number one performer. Silver stocks over time. If you look at silver stocks over the last 6 to 9 months, they've held up very well relative to gold stocks. Again, I think the big question is, how long does this cycle run? I think from a technical, purely technical point, we could be at a point right now with the NASDAQ taking a breather where markets may want to consolidate and then try again. But the one that always does the best in inflation is silver. But also the flip side of that is the one that will get hit the hardest. Usually the ones that get hit the hardest if the Fed tightens are base metals and silver, which is sort of straddling the fence. So a lot is hanging in the balance here in terms of what happens with Fed policy. I think it's still a major and very important issue.
So, Frank, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about what you do, how can they get in touch?
Jim, I would love to talk to anybody who's interested. I manage money for conservative investors. I manage the twin goals in a series of tactical programs that target really what I would classify as a sort of satisfying return around 5 to 8%, where we also keep a downside risk on the portfolio no more than 2 to 4%. So it has stop losses and risk mitigation overlay on every single thing that we buy. And it's really the goal, and from what I'm trying to do in terms of managing these programs, is to create a conservative or moderately conservative program for people who are suffering right now because there is no 5-year CD yielding 4%. They know they have to get more income than what they've gotten right now. Zero at the bank is not working. And especially with inflation surging, zero at the bank is really a negative real rate, which means your money's contracting. So what I'm trying to do is get people a very reasonable rate of return on their money, taking very little risk and measured risk at that. Intelligent risk is what we're trying to do. If anyone is interested in reaching out to Financial Sense, they can call us at 858-487-3939. And I will be happy to chat with them.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, thanks for joining us. Oh, you know what? I wasn't going to let you go. What's on the menu Friday night?
Oh, Joe, I have no idea. But I got to say one thing. I'm really glad. I'm thinking I'm taking my mom out on Sunday. And I'm just really glad that this economy has loosened up and that the virus is making new lows here. So that people can get out, enjoy themselves. I hope everybody has a wonderful weekend.
Alejandra Grindal, Chief International Economist at Ned Davis Research, joined FS Insider this week to delve into the long-term outlook for inflation. Here is a clip of what she told listeners this week.
Most demographic projections show that these dependency ratios will rise, or working age population will shrink, because these baby boomers will ultimately retire. And this isn't just something that can be observed in the United States, but there was also a baby boom, post-war baby boom in Europe, as well as Japan, and they have this same outlook. So I would say overall, the outlook is for higher inflation throughout most of the developed world.
To listen to this full 30-minute interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Sheridan, host of our weekday FS Insider podcast, and welcome to this week's Smart Macro Edition with our very own Chief Investment Officer, Chris Poplava. Chris, last time we discussed the policy theme songs driving the economy and markets today. Money for nothing, checks for free. I want my MMT, modern monetary theory. The economic policy du jour driving very large budget deficits and a number of investment implications that you discussed both in your quarterly newsletter to clients and in your recent weekly investment meeting. So let's kick things off there and tell us, what are some of the most important things that you think investors need to know about what we're facing for 2021?
One of the things that I think has been kind of a consistent theme of mine this year was that it would be a mistake to become bearish, take money off the table, go to the sidelines, raise cash too early. I think a good analogy would be 2013. 2013, the Fed was launching QE2. And with all that liquidity coming into the market, the S&P finished the year up more than 30%. And even in 2014, when the Fed did start to taper under Ben Bernanke, 2014 was still a good year. Even in the first part of 2015, we continued to advance. It really wasn't only until the middle part of 2015 when we started to have some issues. So the fact that the Fed is not even tapering yet, I think, indicates that there's still a tremendous amount of liquidity coming into the markets, and why I do think it's a mistake to stay on the sidelines, raise cash too early, take profits. I think this is a year in which you want to let your profits run. You want to stay invested, stay with the market, don't fight the Fed, that famous Marty Zweig saying. I think that's what's going to be really important. And one of the things I've been working on with my colleague Ryan Price is coming up with a global stimulus index. And this is basically based on central bank policy. So what we see is that monetary policy does a pretty good job of catching the turns in the economic cycle. For example, our stimulus index leads the ISM manufacturing index by roughly 2 years. And what it shows is that the peak that I have forecasted really doesn't occur until the beginning transition, I would say, is the end of this year into the first half of next year, before I think we might have some trouble in terms of the second half of 2022. But with the ISM PMI already in record territory, or really elevated, north of 60, what I think that means is we're going to see that remain elevated. Usually when we see the ISM get north of 60, it rolls over pretty quickly. It doesn't stay up there. But in light of the massive inventory rebuild that we have undergoing, which will conceivably continue for months on end, I do think we're going to have a very high level of manufacturing well into the end of this year. So I do think there's plenty of stimulus coming, and I don't think really we need to kind of take a different tact until, you know, at least I'd say the end of this year, early next year.
Okay. So as you said, you think it's a mistake to become too bearish at this point, especially given the amount of stimulus in the pipeline. And I want to note, when it comes to the Financial Sense Wealth Management Global Stimulus Index that you've developed, which you show
has a two-year lead on the ISM Manufacturing Index. And as many of our listeners will know, the ISM Manufacturing Index is one of the key indices that many strategists look at for the cyclical ups and downs of the economy. And we'll have that posted. We'll have a number of these charts posted where this interview is located, Financial Sense.
The thing to bear in mind is demand right now is surging, but that's not the only thing we need to think about. We need to think about actually inventory levels. And when we look at inventory to sales ratios, they are still very low. So the manufacturing side of the economy is not just having to operate at a high level to meet current demand. They have to go above and beyond that to replenish the inventories, which were depleted a year ago when manufacturing was shut down and everyone had to work from home. You can't produce widgets at home. And so the manufacturing sector really saw a loss in production that saw inventory levels continue to fall. And the thought was that no one really felt that the demand would come back so quickly when we were all working from home. But with all of the stimulus checks that were sent out, what we saw was that consumers were buying goods. And a lot of those goods are produced overseas. So what we saw was that the trade deficit was ballooning, and we saw, you know, record sales in terms of TVs, appliances. In fact, when we just recently got the March Consumer Confidence Report, and there was a surging level of consumers' attitudes towards buying an automobile. It hit one of the highest levels in 2 years. And when we look at the plans to buy a home, that was the highest level we'd seen in a decade. So there's still a tremendous amount of pent-up demand. Manufacturing will have to be operating at full capacity just to meet that, and even above that in terms of replenishing current inventories.
What are some of the other things that you have on your dashboard that you're looking at that you think have clear market implications for this year and into next year?
One of the things I think we're going to see in terms of the next few months as a pretty significant development is the rest of the world playing catch up to the US and China. China was the first country in the decline and the first one to come out of that economic decline, followed by the US. We've done a pretty good job compared to the rest of the world in terms of our vaccinations. And I think what we're going to see is Europe and Japan and other parts of developed countries starting to get their vaccination schedules going and accelerating. Plus, we're also starting to move into the warmer months, which typically we see decline in caseloads like we did last summer. So I think what we're going to see is some reacceleration in terms of the recovery in Europe and other developed countries, which wasn't derailed, just delayed with the resurgence of COVID during the spring. So I think with the developed world starting to reaccelerate, I think that will put pressure on foreign bond yields, which have not risen to the same extent that U.S. yields have. The one I think is going to be jumping the most and soonest is the Japanese 10-year bond yield. Looking at the Japanese 10-year, what was interesting was that when global bond yields collapsed last year, Japan in 2020 never saw its yield dip below its 2016 or 2019 lows. So Japan was one of the only developed countries that failed to see new lows in its interest rates. And so Japan more or less traded sideways, you know, between 0 and 5 basis points last year. But beginning this year, it had a pretty strong move, just under 20 basis points. And over the last 2 months or so, it's been consolidating. And for me, from a chart perspective, it looks like a bullish wedge. And it's coming back to a recent breakout level. So I think the Japanese 10-year yield is getting ready to assault that 20 basis point level again. And if it can clear that, that would be the highest level for the Japanese 10-year bond yield in 5 years. And it would also, if it can get a little bit north of 20 basis points, it would exceed the low set in 2014. And it would be a major, major breakout in Japanese bond yields. And looking at the German 10-year yield, that one also, interestingly, has more or less over the last 2 years gone sideways. So it got below negative 50 basis points last year, as well as in 2019. And it started to rally pretty strongly this year. And it's back up to almost around, you know, negative 18 basis points or so. And if it can clear that level, that would be a two-year breakout. And that would also, which is important in my view, exceed the low set in 2016. So we've already broken the bearish trend in German 10-year yields, which from 2018 to 2021, that bearish trend has now been broken. We still have resistance around negative 18 basis points, but I think we're getting ready to break out through that. So if we see European bond yields begin to break out, we see Japanese yields begin to break out relative to the U.S., I think this will put pressure on the U.S. dollar.
Along those lines, Chris, you know, when we spoke with you up to a year ago, you had mentioned that if we do continue to see the dollar decline based on the very large twin deficits in the U.S. right now, that's the budget deficit and the trade deficit, that we at Financial Sense Wealth Management were increasingly allocating towards commodities as an anti-dollar play. Can you give us an update on where things stand there? Because we have seen a really big run in the commodity sector. So obviously that was a very good place to put client capital over the past year. So are we trimming those positions? Are we letting them ride?
You know, that's a really good question, Chris. We did turn bearish on the dollar last year. We also turned bearish on bonds. Starting last year, we were exiting our long-term bonds. We were also decreasing our allocation to fixed income and also shortening our maturity of our portfolio. And there's a couple of reasons for that, but essentially we thought it was as good as it gets in terms of the rally in bonds and that we were going to begin an economic recovery. And looking at currencies, there's, you know, one theory, it's called purchasing power parity or PPP. That's one theory that explains the movements in currencies. And there's essentially an interest rate differential often can explain currency movements of one currency versus another or inflation differentials. And one thing I look at is the U.S. real two-year yield relative to the G10 currencies. And what we see is that the U.S. commanded a higher yield or a premium compared to its peers for much of 2015 through 2019 after having a discount earlier in the last decade. But with the collapse in U.S. yields last year, we are at an actual discount in terms of real two-year yields compared to our peers. And so that argues that the U.S. dollar should be a lot weaker than where it is presently. So I think interest rate differentials support a weaker dollar. And then also when you look at the trade deficit, as I mentioned, with all the stimulus checks we have being sent out, our trade deficit is surging. For example, the nominal trade deficit widened from $70.5 billion to a record-breaking $74.4 billion in March. That was the third month in a row that the trade deficit had widened, and that works out to $212.8 billion shortfall just in the first quarter. Now, again, as I was mentioning, that was the worst trade deficit that we had seen ever. You know, back in 2007, 2008, when the dollar was in a very steep bear market, we were averaging anywhere from 65 to 70 billion trade deficit per month back in those years. And the U.S. dollar index was significantly lower than where it is today. So I think looking at our trade deficit, looking at our budget deficit, when you combine those two together, the budget and trade deficit or the twin deficits relative to the size of the economy, that's 22% of GDP. And that blows away any other extreme that we had seen prior to that. So I do think interest rate differentials argue for a weaker dollar. I think the trade deficit will continue to put pressure on the dollar. So that's really what we're kind of getting ready for, is we do feel that the U.S. dollar, which had a pretty steep decline last year, has had a rally since the beginning of this year. And part of that, I think, was that the U.S. again had a vaccination schedule much faster than the rest of the world. So we're reopening quicker than everyone else. And additionally, sentiment towards the dollar became overly bearish. So I think we needed to work off that excessively bearish sentiment in the dollar. And that's, in my opinion, largely happened over the last 4 months. But since the middle of April, the dollar has been declining. And I believe it is renewing its bearish trend and likely to breach the low set in January and head even lower. So essentially, the bearish view that we have on the U.S. dollar is why that we're allocating client capital towards the value sectors versus growth. So that would be financials, energy, commodities, emerging market equities, foreign equities. And that's something that we've been doing, is progressively building those positions.
And again, as this segment is referred to, this is our smart macro segment. As we started discussing with you post-COVID last year, in light of the massive amounts of stimulus that were being pumped into the system, the macro view at that time was for a weakening dollar, higher inflation, and higher interest rates. And so the smart move, we felt, would be to then pare back on bonds and increase exposure into anti-dollar plays, particularly commodities, and then also emerging markets. So that is still the view that is in place at our firm and is what we're doing with clients.
That is correct. As I mentioned, you know, the US dollar did begin to rally over this recent quarter. And what we saw was a little bit of profit taking, mid-cap stocks started to underperform the S&P, commodities, and the energy sector rolled in, financials started to trade sideways, small cap stocks really underperformed the S&P over the last 2 months. But I think with the renewed dollar weakness that we're seeing that reverse back, so that we're starting to see mid-caps and small caps outperform the US, emerging markets are starting to perform well. But, you know, overall, even though I do think that value will outperform growth, as a whole, we still see a very, very healthy bull market. For example, one of the things I take a look at is I want to see where the S&P is relative to its one-year high. And then I look at its internals. So of all of its members, how far away is its average member away from its 52-week high? And oftentimes what I notice is near, you know, significant market tops, while the S&P continues to put new highs, you're starting to see more and more members move into corrective or even bear market periods. And so when I see that internal weakening where the average stock is actually rolling over, not keeping up with the market, that's a warning sign. And currently right now, when I look at the S&P 500, even the mid-cap 400 or S&P small cap 600, I'm seeing a huge increase in terms of participation of stocks hitting new highs, basically either leading the market or at least staying pace with the market. So this is a very broad-based rally. I'm not seeing any warning signs of a possible market top. Now, whenever we get overbought, we can certainly have corrections and pullbacks, but I'm not seeing any signs of a significant peak in the market at this time.
And Chris, lastly, before we close, one of the burning questions on the minds of all of our listeners is, what is your view on Dogecoin?
Honestly, Chris, I don't even follow that one. I mostly follow the main cryptocurrencies. But to me, I think it really just symbolizes the amount of excess liquidity that we have. If we didn't have this tsunami of liquidity, and you know, you and I have made reference to that movie Interstellar with Matthew McConaughey, where you see that massive mountain of water coming towards him on that one planet, that's what we have in terms of liquidity. But if we didn't have that, I don't think you would see, you know, this surge in cryptocurrencies or, you know, high-flying growth stocks. I think really that is symptomatic of the overall backdrop, which is a very, very pedal to the metal stimulus coming from not just the U.S. Fed, but other central banks. And that stimulus is ongoing. You know, there's really no one talking about raising rates. Even Janet Yellen was kind of talking about comments about the U.S. raising rates anytime soon. So I think that wave is still coming. It's still hitting us and it hasn't passed us yet. So I do think that you're going to see crazy things like Dogecoin continue to hit new highs. Who knows where Bitcoin and all the other ones are going, or even the stock market for that matter. So again, as I mentioned, I really think that it would be a mistake to either be too cautious or raise cash and remain on the sidelines. I think this market is just going to, you know, basically overrun the bears out there. There's just a stampede of bulls that I don't see dissipating anytime soon.
Chris, on that note, would you mind telling our listeners about some of the services that we provide here at Financial Sense Wealth Management?
Sure. We provide a whole host of financial services. We provide financial planning, wealth management. We also do 401k servicing, consulting, and we also assist corporations in managing their cash balance, particularly with interest rates at 0%.
If any of our listeners would like to get in touch with our financial advisors, what would be the best way to do so?
They can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you again on Smart Macro. We look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks. That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Don't forget to tell your friends and family about our podcast, Financial Sense News Hour, to stay on top of the latest developments in the market and how they impact your investments. Lastly, if you aren't already a subscriber and would like to listen to more of our premium content airing 3 days during the week through our website or through an app on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.